WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
The bra has an amazingly diverse number of ways in which it has supported, shaped, enhanced, and reduced women's bosoms over the decades. In an earlier era, there was a model with a zip pocket called the money bra, and another that had an inflatable bladder to help you achieve your desired size. My guests Jane Farrell Beck and Colleen Gao have written a new book about the history of the bra in America called Uplift. Beck is a professor of textiles and clothing at Iowa State University. Gao is one of her former students and has her own conservation of textiles business. The bra started to catch on as a healthy alternative to the more restrictive waist-cinching corset in the late 1890s.
The 1890s were a period when various styles of breast supporter were popular with women who were interested in a somewhat reform style of clothing that had a high waist. It did not have the waist cinching aspect of the corset. And these little supporters that they call short stays, or they call strophiums or breast bust girdles, those were some of the types of garments that were worn under that style. The really big breakthrough came in the early 1900s when a very slim form-fitting style called the princess silhouette caught on. And at that point, brassieres, so-called at that point, were very, very popular, started to be very popular with more ordinary women who were not dress reformers.
And the dress reformers wanted to get rid of the very restrictive undergarments. For what reasons?
Well, dress reformers had several different reasons for wanting to change the undergarments. Certainly, they described many of the problems that women had with their health. Very, very tight-waisted things kind of tended to push the innards around in ways that were not normal. Restricted breathing, had all kinds of various problems with the reproductive systems, etc. But in addition to the tight kinds of garments that the dress reformers were trying to get rid of, they were also attempting to reduce the problems of having the heavy weight of clothing. With many, many petticoats, the various very high, wide skirts that were worn in the mid-19th century could weigh 35 or 40 pounds. And that weight essentially dragged down on the waist and hips. In addition to that, there was the whole sanitary aspect of dragging your clothes around on the ground, and particularly in days when they had animals walking up and down the streets and leaving their droppings in the dirt and so on, would really add to the whole health and sanitation aspect of the clothing. So there were very many reasons. Those are just a few of the reasons that dress reformers were trying to change the clothing of women in the 19th century.
I want to just read an ad. One of the great things about your book is it has a lot of ads through history for brassieres. And this is an ad from a catalog for a bra that was sold between the years of 1895 and 1908. And the ad is titled Improved Bust Support. By its use, the weight of the breasts is removed from the dress waist to the shoulders, giving coolness and dress comfort, ventilation, a perfect-shaped bust, and free and easy movement of the body. Made with skirt and hose supporter attachments, high or low bust, catalog free. During this period, at the turn of the century, was there a size of bosom that was considered fashionable?
In the early 1900s, it was fashionable to have a fairly ample bosom, to have not really a division of the breasts. It was sort of what was sometimes in current language called a monobosom, although I don't believe they called it that. But you definitely wanted to have a small waist, a large bosom, and fairly full hips.
And was the bra supposed to add to your size or just give you uplift?
No, it was to give uplift. It was to give comfort. It was to also hold up the skirts, because as you may note in that particular advertisement, there were little straps coming down below the bust cups, and that was to hold the petticoats to relieve some of that weight, because doctors really were convinced that supporting clothing from the shoulders was more healthful than letting it drag down around your waist and hips.
And that bra that I read the ad for, I guess this is in the pre-elastic era, so there's crisscrossed lacing in the front of the bra to hold the bra together and I guess to adjust the size of it as well.
We could say that as far as any extensive elasticity, anything up to the early 1930s would be pretty much pre-elastic. There might be small pieces of elastic. Certainly there was elastic around from the mid-19th century in narrow bands, but no, extensive amounts of elastic didn't really exist. And so, yes, they were adapting the corset concept of lacing as an adjuster to the bust support, to the brassiere.
Now, in the early bra era, at around the turn of the century, when an ample bosom was in vogue, what about cleavage? Was the bra supposed to reveal cleavage?
No, cleavage was really not part of the fashion scene. Evening dresses might have a sort of a low scoop neck, but the idea of push-up and showing the gap between the breasts was not specifically something that was sought after,
at least in the best of circles.
If you're just joining us, my guests are the authors of Uplift, The Bra in America. It's a history of the bra. My guests are Jane Farrell Beck and Colleen Gao. Now, you write that from around 1918 to 1924, that the favored body type was more flat-chested, and in fact, the favored type became flatter and flatter. How did that change the look of the bras? And I don't know if you have any idea about why a more flat-chested look became popular.
Well, I think that with most of the bra styles, the flat-chested look came as a result of the fashion silhouette changing, not only in Paris but in New York, by some of the more influential fashion designers. And they began to focus on a more tubular or boyish look. And during the early 20s, late teens, that particular tubular silhouette in the fashion world became popular. Now, it certainly didn't flatter very many figures, and it was a difficult thing to try and achieve for the more buxom of the clients that were trying to purchase brassieres. But I think that most of those tended to be what we would actually think of as breast binders rather than what we might consider a brassiere, but they were still marketed as brassieres.
I want to skip ahead to World War II. Let me read a World War II ad from your book, Uplift, on the history of the bra. And the ad is headlined, "Active women need support. To keep your war job energy at its peak, your supporting garments must be well-constructed and comfortable. This girdle and brassiere are individually designed for the wearer." And there's a picture of a Rosie the Riveter-type worker, hard at work with a wrench in her hands, wearing one of these bras.
Well, definitely throughout the entire 19th century and well into the 20th century, the idea of a woman's form, particularly by males, was considered to be weaker, that she needed some kind of support. And the people that were planning for women to go into the workforce, particularly in heavier laboring types of jobs, felt that it was very, very necessary for those workers to wear very strong, supportive garments. And so that the girdle that is shown in this particular picture and the brassiere, some of which in the wartime actually had protective layers of metal or plastic above them to protect the woman's breasts or bosom area, were used by many manufacturers and recommended not only by the manufacturers but by people that were in industry.
May I just add that, in fact, because these women were standing for long periods of time, they may have benefited a little bit from the back support that a high-rise girdle, frequently panty girdle, and a brassiere could provide. Actually, in war plants, doctors and nurses who work there would often recommend to women to get some kind of support, not very different from the sorts of back supports we see by people working in warehouse type of retail outlets today.
I know when I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, watching a lot of movies, and many of those movies were from the 50s, I thought, wow, women in Hollywood really had large breasts, you know. No one I know seems to have breasts quite that large. And then, of course, you get older and you read about the bullet bra, which is this like big padded bra that a lot of women in Hollywood during that era had to wear. What are some of the interesting things you learned about the big pointy breast look of part of the 50s?
Well, there are so many funny stories to tell, it's hard to know where to start. But certainly the designers just post-war and into the early parts of the 50s really did put an emphasis on the separated breast and the very torpedo-like breasts. And a lot of that was achieved through stitching of the cups in various types of circular stitches that were called variously whirlpool and circular form and a lot of different kinds of stitching that achieved that very pointed look. But it was, again, a function of the fashion silhouette of the time. The post-war period allowed for fabric to be used in higher quantities so that full skirts could be available and crinolines could be put underneath them. And the emphasis on the waist cinched in and the very pointed breast was very much popular as a fashion silhouette.
Whose brainchild was the training bra? Why don't you describe what a training bra is?
The training bra in our modern parlance refers to a bra for a very young girl, usually a preteen. We're not sure what they're training for, but but the concept of a brassiere for a quite young woman, it goes back to the 19-teens. In fact, the flappers themselves go back to the 19-teens. They were teenagers at that time. The term seems to have grown up with those young women. But from that point on, a teen market was very important. Increasingly, these girls were having jobs, earning their own spending money, and both manufacturers and retailers were very eager to court their business. In fact, some companies actually fully specialized. Teen Charm, Heaven Teen, Holly Bra, those all really targeted the teenager. And in fact, there was a tendency for young women to mature sooner. In the 50s, they were adopting lipstick and high heels in their mid to young teens. And so along with this went the concept of a small bra, a bra with very slight contouring.
My guests are Jane Farrell Beck and Colleen Gao, authors of Uplift, The Bra in America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Jane Farrell Beck and Colleen Gao, authors of a new book about the history of the bra in America called Uplift. Do you remember, I forget which Woody Allen movie it is, but it's like a Sunday morning and he's reading the New York Times magazine section with this real lascivious look on his face. And it turns out what he's looking at is the ads for women's underwear. And that reminds me that, you know, it seems like throughout the history of the bra that there have been ads picturing women wearing bras in publications that wouldn't otherwise be showing women in their undergarments. And it's always actually kind of surprised me that even in very conservative climates that it's been okay to show women in their underwear in advertisements.
You will notice, however, that many times, particularly up through perhaps the late 1940s, often the sketches, they would be sketches of women, or it would be the woman's pose turned away from the viewer somewhat, or her eyes dropped, sort of detaching herself from the viewer that would be acceptable. One of the great accomplishments of the Maiden Form campaign, which started in 1949 and ran through the late 1960s, was to make it okay to show women in sort of fantasy situations with bra above and a full apparel below.
The campaign you're talking about is the, like, I Dreamed I...
The Dream Campaign. The Dream Thank campaign. You, yes.
Do you remember some of the examples, what the woman was dreaming she was doing while wearing her Maiden Form bra?
I dreamed. I was a mermaid. I dreamed. I won the election, which I thought was quite interesting.
So it'd be like, I dreamed I won the election in my maiden form bra.
Form bra. Oh, yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. I dreamed. I went to Paris in my maiden form bra. I dreamed. I rode a streetcar in my maiden form bra.
The first one was, I dreamed I went shopping in my maiden form bra. And that theme was actually repeated more than once throughout the campaign with different models. Shopping was very big.
And the business corresponding set of advertisements would say, I dreamed I became president of the store in my maiden form bra. I dreamed I sold $1 million worth of brassieres of my maiden form bras.
Were you able to find out who developed the sizing system of the A cup and the double A cup, et cetera?
Yes, Colleen.
Yes, that was fairly difficult to find, but we've discovered that the Camp company that actually dealt primarily with prostheses for mastectomy patients came up with the letter system A, B, C, and D to help make prostheses that would fit particular women's breasts as a match. And that was quite quickly taken on in other companies. I believe that the year for that was 1931.
I think both FormFit and Warner's were rather early off the mark in modifying their cup sizes, but it was Camp that gave the labels A, B, C, and D, and then, of course, led to lots of jokes about it. For example, Ruth Kapanis, a brassiere designer, referred to the sizes as nubbins, snubbins, droopers, and super droopers.
When did black bras start becoming available?
1930s, but gained greater popularity, particularly in the post-war era, partly because it was a matter of something that could be worn only for certain types with certain types of clothing. And so as people were more affluent, they could have a wardrobe of brassieres that not only included different shapings, but different colors, different materials, and even different prints by the late 1950s, and certainly riotous colors in the 1960s.
I think, too, Terry, that black was often associated with eroticism or being more sexy. And I think that may have come as a result of the French introduction of black and lacy undergarments, and many of which were brought home after the Second World War by the various troops that were over there. And so the eroticism aspect of underwear has always been there at one point or another.
What do you think the impact of Victoria's Secret has been on bras and the whole bra industry?
I could say that it's been fairly profound, I would say. It's brought the undergarments and brassieres and underpants particularly right onto the primetime television screen in the home of every place in America and indeed the world. It's on the internet, etc. And I think that it's really taken the brassiere and underclothing to a complete new level. Their marketing campaign, I think, has had a terrific amount of strategy, and I think it's succeeded very admirably.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us about the history of the bra. Thank you.
Well, we're delighted that you liked our book, and we're just thrilled that this is going to be on, Terry.
Thank you indeed for including us in your list of interviewees.
Absolutely.
Jane Farrell Beck and Colin Gao are the authors of Uplift, The Bra in America.